Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
We want people out doing things, but safely. Putting arrows on the ground on the street to say walk this direction here and the other direction there just doesn't work. People don't follow those, they wander into the other lanes.
How we get from A to B in our cities is all about reading the signs. On today's show, we look at wayfinding and city signage to explore where our information comes from and how it shapes how we navigate our streets. We find out about the evolving world of wayfinding with an expert in the industry, explore how street names can be a powerful tool for change, and has our producer gone to the dogs? That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. The symbols, signs and markers that appear all over our cities are often a barely noticed feature of the places that we call home. Wayfinding is a vital tool in urban centres, transportation systems and healthcare facilities in order to convey information that's important to people of all languages and levels of understanding. And done well, is unobtrusive, more encouraging than shouty. This task has been especially important during the coronavirus pandemic, as rules for public interaction have changed almost by the day. Tim Fendley is the founder of the London-based wayfinding experts Applied, who are working with their clients to implement new systems and wayfinding tools that will help in post-COVID-19 environments. He was also the very last guest who we invited into this studio before the coronavirus meant that we had to shut our studio doors to outsiders. But the world changed quickly and our conversation was soon out of date. So we've invited Tim back to the show, this time down the line from his home. Tim, thank you so much for joining us again. As I said, the world has certainly changed and that's a new world that you're trying to interpret for your clients. There's an overwhelming amount of new information that the public needs to glean through wayfinding efforts. What's been your response in the past few weeks and how are you thinking on your feet in terms of what's needed and what are you coming up with as solutions?
Everything has changed, hasn't it, since we spoke. It's amazing how the whole world has changed. What are we doing about it? I think firstly, we realised that what we do when we're working at a much slower speed, trying to help complex environments to reduce friction, has a lot of application in this environment where we're dealing with the public. All of us have got habits of what we do that don't really suit how we need to behave with the virus. So it's our habit to shake hands, to hug. It's our habit to get close to people. It's our habit to touch surfaces that really, to keep us all safe and to keep this virus under control, we need to reduce. And that takes thinking about how you do behavior change. And I think when the government put out the rule, stay at home, we all got that. We all did it. Now we're in this next 12 months, maybe 18 months, we're in this kind of second phase of not lockdown, but yet socially distancing. And this means we've got to really challenge our habits.
Okay, but here's the challenge, Tim, that a lot of the work that you do is about delivering simplicity, stripping back the signage and the overwhelming number of signals we catch in our eye every day to make sure that we get messages in a very direct way, but not overwhelming us with information. I've walked around London in the last couple of days, and people are putting in new wayfinding systems for exactly this. And I find them overwhelming, off-putting, a little bit sad, and they don't encourage me out into the urban landscape. For example, in retail streets not far from where we are now, they've put white arrows down every pavement showing you one-directional routes. They have put big signs up saying, have you got a face mask on? All stuck on the pavement on big stickers. And it kind of makes you want to go home. So how do you begin to affect people's behaviour without making the whole experience miserable?
Okay, so I think the big idea here is, from what we know about behaviour change and what we know about, like you said, how do you reduce friction? The big problem is that every organization is working really hard to do what they can to keep us safe. The result of that is that everybody's doing different things. They're going the whole way to put stickers everywhere, to tell you where to stand, arrows, where to walk. The problem is that everybody's doing it differently. That means that the public walking around is just hit by this, I think you've just described it perfectly, this cacophony of noise. And that means we're probably not going to see anything. And our reaction is the one that you just said, which is, wow, this is too much. I'm going to give up. I'm not going to do this, which is not what we all want of our streets. We want our economies to continue. We want people out doing things, but safely. We think the solution is there needs to be much more coordination and one system, and to only do things that are actually going to work. We know, for example, that putting arrows on the ground on the street to say, walk this way, in this direction here and the other direction there, just doesn't work. People don't follow those. They wander into the other lanes so easily. Look at cycle lanes in Amsterdam. People are often walking into them. It just doesn't work. It's not effective. You know, I applaud the energy that everybody's put into putting this information out there, but it's just going to start to confuse. We're leading a plan to simplify this and to coordinate it.
So, for example, if you're speaking to a city, are you trying to make sure that public transit, then the city authorities, you know, who take control of pavements, and then owners of large organisations and corporations are all kind of buying into the same set of principles and of signals and of design as well?
That's right. Because really the public just wants one system, right? We can only afford to learn one system. I want to learn one system. And the keys to it is that it needs to be really clear. It needs to look temporary, because we're basically saying this is a temporary situation. Okay, it might last 12 months, but it's temporary. It needs to be really clear. It needs to be reasonably commanding. And in clear, what I mean is you've got to make it really clear to people, this is a face mask wearing area, or it's not. And then make sure you follow through on that. So it's really good. I think the government came out with public transport need to wear a face mask, because that means we'll adopt that new habit. And then it'll feel reasonably normal, even though I don't particularly like it, but it'll feel much more normal to be wearing a face mask in indoor spaces. So it needs to be really clear. We've got to get the virus visible. We've got to make it clear that there is virus, and therefore that's why we're doing all of these things. And I think most of all, it needs to be consistent. And that's the hardest one to do.
And tell me tone, because that's the other interesting thing, is that this is a health emergency. It is a global health crisis. It's a pandemic. So it's a big, scary thing. And we're talking about behavioural changes, which we want from people to protect their health and protect the health of others. So when you deliver the tone of this, are you trying to pick up the health message? Are you trying to shock people a little bit? Are you trying to gently advise, nudge? What's the tone of the wayfinding that you're trying to deliver?
Well, that's a really good question. So here's the thing. If you want to change anybody's behaviour, you've got to really engage them. When we did Legible London, we worked really hard on designing maps that were as beautiful as we could get them and yet worked. The idea was that we would draw people in using the virtue of the design, draw people into a map that they're not normally used to using a map, and yet they're going to feel good about this, hence why we put the 3D buildings on and things. We tested this and we drew people in order to affect behavior change, in order for them to calculate their route, to work out where they are, to do something. We've seen a lot of kind of like marketing and advertising led ways of talking about your behavior. And again, that doesn't necessarily draw you in. In how we need to communicate COVID is it needs to be much more like public information. And I think your example there is also spot on. It's a bit like on the motorway when you get the 40 sign coming up and yet there's no danger. You just keep going until you see something. It loses its strength of telling you how to behave if it's overused. So again, clear guidance on where to use a face mask, and then clear information of this is a face mask wearing area and this isn't, is the tone that we should be adopting. I feel there is a balance here with not wanting it to feel dangerous, but I think the other side of that is that it needs to be a health emergency and we need you to play your part. And we're going to be really clear about what you need to do.
Another thing, as you say, hopefully this is temporary. Hopefully, you know, maybe in 12 months' time, this will be in the rearview mirror. So you're talking to already city authorities and to corporations who are furloughing staff, about to let people go, can't get enough people on public transport to make it viable in the future, see their coffers being emptied. So I presume when you engage with these people, first of all, this solution needs to be pretty cheap as well, does it? And are you having to think about, actually, there's no point in saying to somebody this is, you know, £1 million project if they think they're going to be peeling up the stickers and taking down the signs and disengaging from all of this within months?
Absolutely. What we're working on is a universal set of guidelines of how to do this, because we see these situations appear everywhere that we can then distribute. And I think this is a situation of, it's a bit like a big event. This is temporary signing, temporary information in the environment. It needs to look temporary because, you know, the message is that we will be returning to normal. These will be going down at some point. And the legacy will be that we might have learned some new good habits. You know, the way in which I think cycling has doubled in London. And we hope that there'll be a kind of like a hangover from that. And a lot of people will be cycling after the event. And I think that's only a good thing.
As you say, there's going to be a shift in mobility as well. And that's also part of the work that you do. So you may know, not know this, but I'm a person of great power. I've got my own city and several companies and a university, and I'm in charge of all the subway as well. I give you a call. Give me the first two or three kind of questions you're going to say to me and my team. What do you think are the first things we need to start thinking about as we get our metropolis going again? What would be the first two or three things you're going to plant in our mind?
I think the first thing is, where most people are and where you might be with your city is you're kind of in phase one, where there's a whole load of energy has gone into changing the environment, setting up one-way systems, queuing systems, limiting the number of people on a carriage, on a tube, for example. And a whole load of operational work has gone on, and that is great. Phase two means, how do we get the public to change their behavior? And I would be saying, how are you going to tackle that? When the things that I've just talked about, the need for consistency and the need for a clear language, are going to be paramount. The need to understand, how do you do change people's behavior? Because we've now got to get the public to play their part. And that might mean changing some of your environments a bit more, adjusting them, learning from what you're doing, being agile, failing fast and thinking that doesn't work, let's change that. I think the biggest challenge for these organizations is actually organizationally. How do you collectively work together for the greater good? And that needs to be guided by some scientific, well-worn, knowledgeable ways of doing this that people like us can provide.
And just finally, tell me, again, the work you do, the consumer of it, they often think, oh, it's a wonderful piece of design. I wonder how long that took them to do. Oddly, the work you do is the culmination of years of experience and working with behaviourists and finding out how we think and behave. Now you're being asked to do something at high speed. How confident are you that with a bit of intervention, you can make us start behaving or help us start behaving in a different way at speed?
I think you said it. We've been doing this for many years and we know how things work. Our projects are normally long because it takes a long time to explain and adapt this for that environment. We realize we're running at breakneck speed, so we're cutting out all the consultation and we're just saying, this is how it needs to work. This is what works. And this is kind of like how you need to tackle it. And we're trying to talk to as many organizations as we can overnight, rather than building a six-month project to really understand. We're saying, here are the key guides, here are the key things to think about. This is what the science is. So for example, we've gone and we've researched all the science, and there is a lot of differing views about the 1 meter, 2 meter or more social distance, for example. But one of the aspects about that that we've seen in all the science is it's very context specific. So the 2 meters comes into effect when you're really 20 minutes with somebody in an indoor space. If you're outdoors, it's much less chance of any transfer. And if you're crossing somebody in the street, just passing them within 30 centimeters, you're really not going to catch it. Yet, one of the reactions has been to massively widen pedestrian streets And like you said, put arrows on the ground so that people aren't passing each other. So a whole lot of energy has been put into an area that isn't going to get the transfer. And what is our real objective here is we're trying to stop the virus from spreading. Each city, each building, each transport system is trying to stop an outbreak, because that's what I think the next 12 months, 18 months is going to be, is when there are outbreaks, places are going to get locked down again and it's going to keep popping up. And your city, you don't want to have outbreaks. And that means you're going to need the public to, we're calling it a dance. How do we do the coronavirus dance? How do we all dance together without stepping on each other's toes? Well, it needs to be choreographed.
Tim Fenley, founder of the London-based Wayfinding Experts Applied, thank you for joining me. Next, we hit the streets in Washington, D.C. This is The Urbanist. Following the killing of George Floyd in Minnesota in May this year, protests and demonstrations swept the United States, calling for changes not just in policing, but also the institutionalized racism abundant in the country. Protest actions have taken all forms, and one that has been replicated around the US are the large yellow murals popping up on streets reading Black Lives Matter. This particular form of demonstration started on 16th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., the street which leads up to the White House. D.C. even went a step further in renaming the section of the street Black Lives Matter Plaza. Well, I'm joined now by the Washington, D.C.-based journalist Christina Sturdivant-Sani to discuss how this piece of urban activism came about. Christina, thank you so much for joining us on The Urbanist. This mural that was commissioned by Washington, D.C.'s mayor, Muriel Bowser, has been seen in newspapers and on screens all around the world. But could you tell us what the reaction to it has been so far from people in D.C.?
I mean, I can talk personally for myself. When I first saw it on Twitter, you know, as a D.C. native, I grew up born and raised in Washington, D.C., and I'm a Black woman, so I was thrilled to see it. It made me really happy. It made me really proud to be a native Washingtonian. And I know that a lot of fellow Washingtonians, Black Washingtonians, felt the same way. So I think at first glance, it got a really, really great reaction. A lot of people flocked to the space. I think it went up around June 6th or so. And ever since then, people have like flocked to the space. I think there's a photo of like a little Black girl skating on the plaza and people are taking photos and all of these things. It's really beautiful to see. But on the flip side, as a journalist, you know, looking at all sides, I'll say that Black Lives Matter DC have historically been kind of opposed to Mayor Bowser and some of her practices. And so when they saw it, they commented on Twitter that it was performative. And, you know, it's nice to see paint on the ground and it's nice to see a street renamed, but what are you going to do about the real issues that Black people have? And they were so reactive to the point that now, if you go to Black Lives Matter Plaza, you'll see the yellow paint that says Black Lives Matter and the flag, but activists actually painted right next to that defund the police. So now it reads Black Lives Matter equals defund the police in bright yellow letters, which is really a testament to the activist community in D.C. And obviously, President Trump didn't have kind words for Mayor Bowser on Twitter when he saw the mural and the street naming.
And can you tell outsiders, you know, who don't know the politics of Washington, because the mayor is also a Black woman, what is the difficulty that some of the Black Lives Matter people find with her period of control in the city?
Well, I'll say specific to this time that we're in, the mayor has drawn criticism for increasing funding for traditional policing while cutting non-police violence reduction programs in her budget. So the budget for D.C., coming up, she's actually increased funding for the police and reduced funding for non-police violence reduction programs, which is what Black Lives Matter DC activists are asking for. So in particular, that's the tension around the situation right now.
And coming back to the renaming of the street and the mural, what do you think can be the impact of this? What do you think can be the significance of this?
I mean, just the imagery, I think, is really bold as far as the paint and as far as renaming the street. So I think even on an emotional level for Black people to see that. It's very heartwarming. And also for non-Black people to see it, I feel like it can be a sign of respect. Like, this is Black Lives Matter Plaza. DC is historically a predominantly Black city. It used to be known as Chocolate City in the early 90s, even though the demographics are changing now. So I feel like for Black people, it's a symbol of feeling loved and appreciated and feeling safe and feeling seen. And then for non-Black people, it is a symbol of respect us. And, you know, we are human and we deserve to be treated as such. And then long-term, I would hope that it's a reminder to not just change the street sign, but to actually make change, like in legislation and in policies and law and just the way that cities operate. So it could do a lot, but it has to be a long-term plan. Like, this sign is only the beginning of something that should be much greater.
And Christina, in the city, you know, there have been calls for other symbols of the past to be removed, but is there also pressure to rename other streets and to wipe away some of the moments in history that don't seem to fit with today?
At the moment, I don't think so. I think most of the focus is probably around renaming schools and institutions, as well as taking down statues. There's actually Woodrow Wilson High School. It's a public high school in DC. It's the most diverse public high school in DC. And a lot of people for years, I believe, have been calling for the school to be renamed because of Woodrow Wilson's associations with slavery, like anti-Blackness. But yeah, a lot of people have been calling for schools to be renamed.
And finally, just coming back to the point you made at the top there, you know, that your description of going to see this mural and the renamed plaza, you were obviously full of emotion and it was jubilant and a moment of change. And I know that many other cities have tried to copy or tried to have their versions of this as well. How valuable do you think that is in the short and the long term as we try to effect real change around this question?
I mean, I think it's incredibly valuable. You know, I was listening to a podcast yesterday, I think it was Code Switch by NPR, and they had a segment on why so many white people all of a sudden are speaking out against racism and against anti-Blackness and police brutality. And one of the things that came out of the conversation was that more white people feel like they're able to speak about it because their other white friends are. So the more people do it, the less you stand out. And so I feel like with renaming the street, Black Lives Matter Plaza, and people duplicating the yellow paint across in other cities, the more people do it, the more it'll be normalized and the more it'll be respected and the more it'll be appreciated long term. Because if only DC did it, you know, it might just be like an isolated thing. But if dozens of cities are doing it, then, you know, it's going to get more attention. It's going to get more respect and people are going to think through it more.
Christina Sturdivant-Sani, the freelance journalist based in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us. And finally, on today's show, just how much attention do you pay to signage when holidaying in a city for the first time? Well, if you're anything like me, the only sign I pay attention to is the lifeguard on duty sign. But for the urbanist producer, Carlotta Ribello, one of her holiday hobbies is to look for signs featuring dogs. Yes, really. Maybe she's been doing this show a little too long. Let's see what she has to say on the topic.
What does your photo album look like after a holiday? Well, I have a confession to make. In the midst of scenic images of squares, nice-looking architecture, and yeah, a few sunset snaps, I always end up with one or two of dog signs. Really. Now, I'm not particularly interested in the instructions that come attached to them. Keep dogs on leads, or only assistance dogs allowed. It's the actual depiction of the pooch itself that sort of fascinates me. Some of them are quite simple. There's no way you could go wrong with a black-on-white icon of our furry friends. That is a very straightforward sign to read. But some cities or countries go the extra mile. You might find a collar, and this too has variations, from a simple white collar to one with details. Are those studs I spot on that beware of the dog sign in California? What about spotting the actual four legs? Not many countries do that, but kudos to the Czech Republic for making the effort. Then you have the question of, is the dog on its own? No, so let's add a happy owner walking it on a lead. With some, you can immediately tell this is a leisurely, regular walk. Both pooch and owner are happy. But I remember spotting a sign in Porto, Portugal, where the person on the other end of the lead seemed to be the one going for a walk rather than the dog. Maybe he just needs to get out of the house a little bit more. And please don't forget about the perky tail. Some signs make a point of showing you how this is the highlight of your dog's day. Just look at it. You can almost see it wagging without the need to add movement lines. And if we're talking about breeds, it seems that any beware signs like to don a version of a German Shepherd, behaved pooches tend to be a variation of Shiba Inus, and then is that a version of a Scottish Terrier I spot? But well, we couldn't talk about dog signs without mentioning the main reason why they exist. Yes, it's time to go poo-poo. But not there! In Italy, it's a very clear sign. Happy pooch, it's business on the floor, and a big red cross over it. In New York, I saw another happy pooch, lifting its leg and surrounded by a green circle. Now that's the spot. But I wonder, are only male dogs allowed to go about their business there? For Monocle, I'm Carlotta Babello.
And that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Rabello and David Stevens. And David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, here's Jordan Rakey with Signs. Thank you for listening, city lovers. And I'm running round in circles, flying high above the ground. And I'm searching out.